The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for coming. I just want to, again, you know, welcome our comrades from the PRT in Mexico, the Partido Revolucionario de las y los Trabajadores. So, you know, as our comrade introduced, Luis, right, organizer, longtime organizer also in the student movement, and Josie, a longtime organizer in the feminist movement. And you know, I really want to thank the conference committee because they really did a great job in bringing the comrades from Mexico. This is actually the fourth time that we have a delegation from the PRT in Mexico coming for four consecutive years. So, you know, big shout out to Sean Larson and Todd, who helped with a lot of the logistics as well. And this is a relationship that we've been working on with the PRT for 5 years now. We started having a working relationship as the ISO and as the PRT in 2014. And since then, you know, it's been growing. We just had a tour of California. One of their comrades did a four-city tour. One of their comrades in California did a four-city tour as well. Fausto, some of you might have met him, San Diego, Los Angeles, Oakland, and San Francisco. And so this is an ongoing relationship. And I think, you know, obviously, it points to the importance that our organization is putting, right, on an emphasis on Latin American politics as well. This session, though, is specifically important because Mexico has been Donald Trump's punching bag for quite a while now, right? All the way from the border to the racist accusations of about Mexican immigrants and Central American immigrants as well. But I think that, you know, besides the racist caricatures of Trump and his bigotry, it also, unfortunately, I think that there is very little understanding of what is going on in terms of Mexican politics in Mexico itself and how it affects the U.S. and Latin America. So what brings us to this session, right, is a situation in Mexico of a rapidly changing political scenarios with the election that just took place in 2018. So that's what I'm going to talk about in my introduction. I'm going to talk about the meaning of this election and the victory of Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who we will refer to as AMLO. That's the acronym that is used in the press. And, you know, we're trying to digest a lot of what the meaning of his victory. We're still trying to digest it because it is actually such a big event in Mexican politics. It's, you know, the election took place this Sunday. The consequences of what that means in terms of senators, in terms of governorships, etc., it's still playing out. But we kind of think we have a final picture of that. But so we're going to talk about the meaning of that, which is actually very monumental. And then there's, of course, you know, the questions, right, of, you know, what changes with AMLO's victory, and then what doesn't change as well. And the last section I'll focus on is, you know, the tensions and contradictions within AMLO's party and project. And then, you know, I will conclude with some comments on what the left is trying to do in response to this, right, with the socialist revolutionary left. Okay, so just to put in context, you know, for, you know, what is the meaning of AMLO's victory? You know, it's something that I think all three of us have been kind of trying to grapple with in our hotel room. We're sharing a hotel room. We're talking Mexican politics back and forth. And, you know, besides the 3,000 posts for public opinion that were for public vote that were up for grabs, right, all the way from local mayors to the presidents, you also had governors. You also had both houses of Congress, right, the upper house and the lower house were also up for re-election. So there was only two states that were not in that same electoral cycle, but the electoral cycle is really, really huge. And so what is even more important, right, besides one of the largest elections in Mexican history, is the sweep by Andrés Manuel López Obrador. You know, the headlines in the newspapers the next day was basically landslide, deluge, sweep, right? And this is, you know, it kind of gives you an idea. I'll just mention a few very brief things because, you know, of time, we can get more of it into the discussion. But Andrés Manuel López Obrador won 31 out of the 32 states in Mexico as a majority candidate with his party in both houses of Congress, in most states as well. In some states, he won with a 60% landslide in Quintana Roo, Chiapas, Oaxaca, Nayarit, Sinaloa, Morelos, and others. In other states, like in Mexico City, for example, Puebla, Colima, and Zacatecas, he won with a 50% voting on his favor, and then he also won with 40% in other states. This is in a three-way race with four-way race with four candidates, right? So he just continuously slammed all of the other candidates. He only lost in Guanajuato, which is the Catholic, pretty much Catholic conservative state, home of the National Action Party, the PAN. So what this means is basically that AMLO has a clear mandate to impose his agenda, whichever agenda he wants to put forth, right? And so this could be very, very exciting. But at the same time, I think we also want to be sober about the project that AMLO won with when he came to the election. My argument is that, you know, his project has changed from when he launched it in 2006, 2008 to what he now put on the ballot. I also want to just put the broader context of the electoral terrain that we had for this election. Two of the main candidates that were competing with AMLO was, one of them was José Antonio Meade. Meade is from the regime's Partido Revolucionario Institucional, the PRI, which is basically the regime party, the party that had been in power for 70 years up until 2000, right? And then they came back in 2012 based on electoral fraud. And so there was this just disgust in the Mexican electorate to just get these bums out at any cost, because they were just, people were so tired. And that's, I think, one of the other things that we want to underline, that people showed up to the polls because they were just tired of the country, the direction the country was going in, and they wanted something else. And Morena and AMLO and their project offered something else. The other candidate was the kind of the competitor, the closest competitor to AMLO, even though he lost by like a 20-point margin. Was in a coalition with the National Action Party, the Catholic Party, and a few other parties that we can talk about later. But Ricardo Anaya basically, had been a complicit ally with the regime. They signed the Pact for Mexico, which basically passed a set of structural reforms to neoliberalize Mexican economy further, and to privatize the oil industry, etc. And, you know, this guy, Ricardo Anaya, he tried to kind of separate himself from the party which he had worked in, the PRI, but it's completely not a choice for many Mexicans. Anaya actually owns a mansion in, Yes, thank you. A lot of acronyms, okay. Anaya actually has $1 million house in Atlanta, in a very exclusive suburb. His children go to elite private schools in Atlanta. And this is basically the Mexican ruling class that, right, try to control political and economic power in Mexico, but their children are sent abroad to European schools, to American schools, etc. Anaya's kids, for example, go to a special high school, a private high school called High Meadows School, where the tuition is $20,000 a year per kid. And he has three kids, so that's, you know, $60,000 a year per year. And I'm sure there's more than that. But so that's kind of the other candidate that was trying to compete with AMLO. And AMLO, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, really represented something very, very different. So when AMLO comes to this election of 2018, after two electoral frauds, one in 2006 and one in 2012, committed by the PAN and the PRI, they were both helping each other, basically, they didn't want him to win. But the project that AMLO brought has been increasingly diluted of its kind of more leftist or radical politics. Many people have tried to say, oh, he's like the Bernie Sanders of Mexico, or he's like the Jeremy Corbyn. Some, you know, lunatics say that he's like the Trump, but that has nothing, you know, that I don't know where that is from. But some people say that he's like Bernie Sanders or Corbyn. And it's like, oh, that's cool then, right? But, you know, when you actually look at his program, it's been more and more diluted, because he's been making a lot of alliances with the Mexican ruling class to try to become more palatable and accepting by the ruling class. Besides, of course, he makes a lot of alliances with popular movements and NGOs and organizations, right, that are pulling in voters. But he also makes alliances with corrupt union leaders like Napoleon Gomez Urrutia. He's the leaders of the miners union. He's been like the leader, and before him, his dad was the leader of the miners union, et cetera, et cetera. So these are like very corrupt union bosses. And in exchange of the votes from the miners union, Gomez Urrutia is going to get a seat in the Senate, right? So that's kind of the deals that AMLO has been cutting. Another one is with the maestra Elba Esther Gordillo, who was like a corrupt union boss in the teachers union. So they're also kind of cozying up as well in the lead up to this election. AMLO also made a lot of alliances with other political parties as well. And so former politicians of the PRI and the PAN, the regime and the mafia of power that AMLO always complained about, many of those politicians jumped into his party when he launched the party, Morena, right? So a lot of the politicians in Morena are actually former PRI or former PRD members, okay? So that kind of should give you an idea. Among these, for example, in the state of Puebla, a guy by the last name of Barbosa, who was part of the Moreno Valle administration. Anyway, lots of nitty gritty, but we can talk about that later. But the most, I think, alarming alliances are those that he has made with the ruling class. AMLO has made peace with the regime in power. He also said that he would institute an amnesty for corrupt leaders, for corrupt politicians and business people, and that in this amnesty, right, he wants the everyone to kind of get along. He has made coalitions with the two largest television networks in Mexico. They're kind of their friends now. Before, they were always undermining him, and also other people that are at the top of, you know, all of these like rich foundations, as well as some in-laws of the richest man in Mexico, Carlos Slim. Carlos Slim's in-laws are in AMLO's party, for example, right? So it's kind of like all of the ruling class is also trying to get its own piece of the pie in the AMLO administration. So that's kind of what AMLO was bringing, which was very palatable to the ruling class. They said, well, look at the disaster that the PRI left behind and the PAN before that, a drug war, mass murders, right, mass graves, etc. And the ruling class said, that's not good for business, right? So let's support AMLO. And AMLO kind of still continues with the neoliberal plan, but wants to, right, be less corrupt. Nevertheless, this election does close, I think, two important cycles, and we can get... what's my time, sorry? Okay, cool. Running out. Okay, there are two important markers. One is that AMLO's election closes the cycle that opens in 1968 when Mexican pro-democracy movements begin to challenge the regime, right? Especially with the Tlatelolco marches that our comrades invoked yesterday at the opening rally with John Carlos here, for example, and Denise Romero, right? In which students and other popular sectors began to criticize the regime's lack of democracy. So I think that there is a closing of that 1968 cycle in which the regime, the PRI, is pretty much really, really weak. They have a handful of senators now in Congress. It also closes the cycle of 1988, in which Rosario Ibarra and Cuauhtemoc Cárdenas and other leaders of the pro-democracy movement, among them our comrades here, who had continuously organized, right, independent campaigns to undermine the regime, etc. To a certain extent, AMLO is a product of the 1988, the pro-democracy movement. And, you know, the regime, again, also tries to undermine all of that. But now he comes to power here. Okay? So I'm just going to mention a few points. I'm running out of time. We can come back to these in the discussion. So now that AMLO has won in this very dramatic sweep, right, what is going to change now that he has, you know, pretty much free reign? There are some symbolic changes. See, he, for example, he's no longer going to use the presidential plane. He's going to fly commercial. He's also going to retire the president's bodyguards, and he's going to have like a smaller team of bodyguards. And he's going to still live in his apartment. He's not going to live in the White House, like the Mexican White House, Los Pinos. He's going to live in his own apartment. And he also has some other interesting, and I think very good, some other policy changes. One that I think is very important is to sign the Treaty of San Andres, San Andres, no? which is a treaty that the Zapatistas tried to propose to the government to basically respect Zapatista autonomy and indigenous self-determination. The Mexican government never signed it since 1994, but AMLO is going to sign that. AMLO also wants to disband the CISEN. CISEN is like the CIA in Mexico. He wants to disband it because different political parties have used it for their own political favors, right? And he also wants to decentralize a lot of the ministries. A lot of the government offices are all in Mexico City. And that is kind of like where the regime kind of got all its power in many ways too, like all the way from roads to telephone poles to tourism to whatever was always in the hands of this small ruling class. So he wants to start spreading that to other parts of the state to kind of let others have a piece of the pie too. But what doesn't change is his commitment to neoliberalism, okay? And I think this should be very clear that AMLO is not a radical in any way, okay? And you know, I would even hesitate calling him center left. I would say more like center right, but he is very committed to neoliberalism. You know, one of the coordinators of his national project told Forbes magazine that Mexico will have to be a paradise for investors with the AMLO administration, and that actually investors, they're asking for fiscal responsibility, but they're going to get more than what they're asking for with this administration. AMLO has also vowed to create special economic zones in some of the poorest states in Mexico. Special economic zones basically, you know, means like no taxes, very little governance, no environmental laws or reviews. And he's going to try to do this in the poorest states in Mexico, Guerrero, Chiapas, Oaxaca, some of the states that are already facing a lot of environmental destruction and indigenous dispossession, right? Dispossession by mining companies, for example. So his project to kind of like jumpstart the economy is very, very problematic. Okay, cool. So let me just wrap up. So what I just want to end with is that although AMLO does come with this clean sweep and this mandate, his project brings many contradictions because he promised investors one thing and he promised Mexican voters something else. And those two visions of what is good for Mexican and American capital and what is good for the Mexican working class and indigenous peoples, those are not compatible projects, okay? And so those are going to be where the tensions are going to be in the coming years. AMLO goes into the presidency in June, in December 1st, that's when he gets in. For us on the left, I'll just conclude on this, right? I think that first we have to acknowledge that the collapse of the regime is very important, right? This is a regime that had been ruling since the aftermath of the Mexican Revolution, a ruthless regime that engaged in disappearances and a dirty war against Mexicans and socialists, but that we also, right, so we have to take the optimism that comes with defeating that regime, but at the same time, we also have to be very sober about AMLO's administration. And we should also come up with like a list of demands for what the left wants, right? There's a few things that we already know that that AMLO administration should do. One is to side with the women's movement to stop all femicides and to start the disappearance of women in Mexico. The other is to sign on to support the electricians union, which the electricians union was disbanded when the electrician company was privatized under the Calderon administration, to support the electrician unions to go back to work. Many of them have been on strike, right, for ¿cuántos años? 10 years now? For the electricians, right? Etc. And of course, to continue defending indigenous autonomy, and as he said, right, to sign the San Andreas Accord, but to commit fully to them. So, you know, in short, I think that we are in an exciting moment because there is a transition of sorts, because Mexican politics are changing and we have this optimism, and we should harness that optimism, but we should also be sober about the possibilities and not just leave it up to AMLO, right? The left has to organize itself and pull with those contradictions to pull from them to get something for our side. Thank you.
Okay, well, Hector's is a talk speech helped me much about facts and so on, so I won't go into that. First of all, thank you to the ISO, to the Socialism Conference for invitation. As Hector said, we think that it's really important that both sides of the socialist and anti-capitalist left in both sides of the border has even more and more relationship knowledge, because obvious reasons, no? So what I'm going to try to explain, it's more or less the new period that we think it's opening. and as a new period, and we think it's a new historic period about that ends, as Hector said, the previous political period that started 30 years ago in the 88. So now we are looking the opening of another period that could last a decade, two decades. It's a long-term political period that it's opening. That's why all the political forces are reorganizing. And at the time, there's not even one week after the election day, so all the political forces and the news, it's quite unclear in many important details. For example, sorry Hector, but specifically we defended the candidature of Gómez Urrutia, the minor leadership. I'm not going to explain that because that will mean to explain the union movement in Mexico, and this is quite complicated and it will take a complete talk. But that can gives you an idea of how complicated it's now the situation. First of all, the first point I want to talk about is how we explain the López Obrador victory. Basically, we can say could be three important reasons. The first one is the split between the agreement that the PRI and the PAN get in the 88. I mean, it becomes a new regime after the revolution. It became the regime of the PRI, 70 years of only one party government that ended in the 88, with disagreement between the PRI and the PAN, which we call the PRIAN. That agreement has been ended after the 2008 crisis, and that gives some kind of space in this electoral campaign, because it's the third campaign for López Obrador. In the two previous, it was clear what was the bet of the regime against López Obrador. This time, the regime, this PRIAN oligarchy, went to the election divided. The second main reason is the turn to the right of López Obrador. No, it's not the same López Obrador in 2006, when he ran for first time to the election, that 2012, and now. Every election, he goes a little bit more to the right, to the right, to the right, in a kind of obsession. We say more or less, if you know the case of Lula in Brazil, like after every new election, he wants to give to Wall Street, to imperialism, to the bourgeoisie, guarantees that he will be a reasonable governor, that he won't do anything crazy and so on. But even though the extreme right and some sectors of the oligarchy still make a huge campaign against him, even illegal campaign of black campaign, saying that if López Obrador wins the election, Mexico will become like Venezuela, and that this is populism and Castro Chavism is coming and shit like that, but it's not true. And the third main reason we think it's the huge anger and rage and that especially in the last 10, 6 years have been growing and growing and growing. Maybe you know about the 2014 crisis and struggles for the presentation with life of the Ayotzinapa students, and all that was a massive eruption of social movement, and we've been facing different cycles of mass demonstrations and questioning that question the regime, and also with a cynical corruption that I mean, we can also have a talk about all the cynical and surrealistic cases of corruption, and that they just doesn't care. There's only for taking one case in Veracruz, the former governor Javier Duarte gave to kids with cancer water with salt, so he can, and he said that it was treatment against cancer, so he can take public money, and that's just one case. I mean. So if you keep going, and especially other reason of anger and indignation is the violence, more than 200,000 deaths and about 40,000 disappeared people in the last 10 years. In the talks that we've gave in previous year, we talk a little bit more about that. So if you want to know about it, you can go to the records of last of the other years. So all this combined can explain why López Obrador won. And the change, of course, it's historic. First of all, because of the PRI, they don't only lose presidency, but they lose even the local, even more local candidatures of municipalities, etc. So that means, because the PRI is a corporative machine that buys votes, so if you want to buy votes, you need the public money, even in the local level. And if you lose that, it's quite difficult that they can come back. One hypothesis is that they will go to Morena, so to a new PRI, and it's one of the dangers. And the other interesting new moment is that the PRD, the Democratic Revolution Party, is, as 2 hours ago, it's not clear so much, but maybe they will even lost the legal register, because Mexican law says that you need to get more than 3% in the national elections to keep existing as a legal party. The PRD now is like in 2.89 or something like that, so it's possible that they want. And that's important for us because when the PRD was founded, it was the left, the big left party, nationalist party, and most all the socialist left went to the PRD, and we say they suicide. In the 88, 89, I wasn't in the PRT, obviously, but our balance sheet is that we stay absolutely alone because all the other left expressions, organizations went to the PRD, they suicide politically inside them, and the result is this one. A party that never won, a party that maybe will lose the legal register with an alliance with the PAN, with the Catholic right, so that left alliance with the Catholic right and so on, involved in corruption, in links with the narco, etc. That's the result of that. And for us that's important because we think that now Morena is taking the same way that the PRD took in this moment, with two differences. The first one is that Morena is going faster. The PRD took about 20 years, 23 years, it's a debate when it stopped to be an opposition nationalist party and became a regime party, but around 20 years. Morena has less than 5 years existence and is going to much more quickly. And the second difference is that the PRD never won the presidency, and Morena has just done it. So what will happen after that? It's also one thing that it will be solved in the next years. And next, what we think now will be some of the things that the new government will have to face difficulties. The first one is that economic neoliberalism, as Hector said, specifically economic neoliberalism, won't be touched. The first thing López Obrador said in the night of election is, don't worry, the central bank will continue autonomous, we will keep a fiscal policy of austerity, etc. The second big issue is NAFTA. López Obrador's transition team will join Peña Nieto's, the actual governor, team in their negotiations with NAFTA. We'll go as a one common team in negotiations with NAFTA that are happening now. The third big point are the structural reforms, especially the educative reform, that is a labor reform, in fact, against the teachers. And the teachers' union have made important strikes and struggles against that, and the energetic reform. The energetic reform, because it privatizes oil, but also it's the reason why the gasoline prices are increasing since the last year. And now López Obrador is saying, on one hand, the gasoline prices won't increase, and you can imagine how surrealistic is that we are an oil country with huge gasoline prices, but at the same time he's not saying that he will back up the energetical reform. So there's another contradiction there. Another important issue is not clear, and that could be interesting for you, about the immigrant policy. I mean, obviously, López Obrador is saying we will defend the Mexican people that are here and they work and they are working people and so on, but it's not clear because after that, López Obrador says, but we are going to talk with Trump and we are going to make him enter into reason with arguments and so on, and you can imagine it as that's a bit difficult, no? And also because he's in NAFTA-bet already. So, and the other important problem that he's going to face is about how to build an alternative development way, because he's saying we will use oil, we will use fossil fuels, we will keep giving miners concessions. Now about 20% of the Mexican territory is concessions to miners, most of them of Canada and China. And there are lots of struggles, like the one that you have against the pipeline here, it's a Standing Rock. Like, we have lots of Standing Rock kind of struggles now in Mexico with indigenous people and so on. So there's another contradiction about that. And other one that is quite important, it's all the feminist and women agenda. As you may know, López Obrador also made an agreement and an alliance with the Encuentro Social Party, which is an evangelic party. It was an alliance that didn't work because Encuentro Social maybe also loses his legal register. He's also down the 3%, even if he was with the winning team. But the price of the alliance is that they will have even a big, congressman. And they will be, if they keep those chairs in the Congress, they will be the difference between having or not more than the 50% of the Congress. Right. So they will have a huge power for negotiate and so on. And they are absolutely against abortion, against women rights, against LGBT rights, and against, they are, yes, fucking evangelics. So, but at the same time, and that can show you the complex of the situation, all this anger and all this rage against violence, against the status quo and so on, went to the polls last Sunday, and they feel, the people is feeling like a victory. Not a victory putting López Obrador in the chair necessarily, but a victory to kick off the pre and the pan, that to give them like slap in their faces. For example, in the night of 1st of July, there was the election. At the night, thousands of people went to Mexico City, Zócalo, main square, and all the people was hugging. It was a party, everybody laughing, and so on. The next day, we lost against Brazil in the World Cup, and nobody cares. it wasn't a tragedy at all, because everybody kept happy and did party and so on. But there's a difference, because when the inauguration day came in December 1st, most of the people of the movement, social movements and so on, we will see the inauguration day in our homes, analyzing the speech and so on. And that's a difference between the 2012 inauguration day, when we made street protesters, and one protester, Compa Cucuy, was killed, one student of the Autonomous University of Mexico City lost his eye because police repression, we have lots of political detentions. That won't happen this 1st of December. So you can imagine that, yes, there are some changes. And finally, some ideas of how we think the anti-capitalist and socialist left have to face this moment. Basically, we think that we need to keep our political independence. The experience of the PRD says us, and also the experience of the so-called progressive governments in Latin America says us, that okay, they are important processes and so on, but we need to keep some independent political independence, because if we don't, maybe we can commit political suicide. But second, we have to know how to dialogue with this joy, with this moment when people are feeling that they can do and they can get their own goals if they propose. So the art is how to make balance sheet between make balance and not became a sectarian alternative that saying that will go wrong and won't work and so on, or getting in the other hand and saying that yes, we won, López Obrador is the best and so on. That's the real important issue now. How we think we can do it? We think now that we need to build some kind of polo, I don't know in English, a front, some kind of process of reorganizing the anti-capitalist left. We had the experience with Marichuy, we had other experiences of how to build anti-capitalist alternatives, and we are now searching, trying to understand the period and making some initiatives that hope can bring us at the end of this new period with an important anti-capitalist socialist force in Mexico that we need more than ever.
I will do it in Spanish. Mr. Lau? Bueno, voy a mencionar algunos aspectos relacionados con la lucha de las mujeres y el contexto previo, lo más significativo y qué pasó con las mujeres en las elecciones.
Okay, so Josie is gonna present in Spanish, as you can tell. She's also gonna mention some of the most relevant aspects of the women's struggle in the previous political context. And she's going to talk about the role of women in these elections.
Well, first I will mention that. I'm sorry. I'm not so fast in English. No, please. Okay. Sorry. It always happens this to me. Siempre me pasa esto. Bueno, en el contexto mexicano, uno de los aspectos que ha atravesado durante hace muchísimos años la situación de las mujeres ha sido todo el contexto de violencia marcado por el incremento del feminicidio, ¿no? Ese es un primer elemento que está en todas las luchas de mujeres y que ha sido un punto de disputa, de debate, de movilizaciones, de propuestas de políticas públicas.
So within the Mexican context, obviously, in the women's struggle, the situation of women, especially violence against women and the increasing number of femicides, right, that is the first issue of the women's struggle in Mexico.
Que situación que se agudizó a partir de la declaración de guerra que hizo Felipe Calderón contra el narcotráfico, que incrementó los casos de feminicidio en las zonas de militarización.
And of course, the femicides became much more acute and grew in the areas where Felipe Calderón increased the war on drugs.
Y a partir del 2009 inició una ofensiva por parte de la derecha en contra del derecho a decidir de las mujeres, impulsando una estrategia para legalizar el derecho a la vida desde la concepción, que lo lograron en 17 estados.
And so we've also seen since 2009 an offensive by the right wing to attack a woman's right to choose. And in 17 states, for example, they were able to pass legislation which treated the conception of, the beginning of life at the point of conception.
Sí, el país llegó a niveles profundísimos de violencia que tocó fondo. Lo que se pudo conocer más a nivel internacional fue el caso de los jóvenes normalistas de Ayotzinapa que fueron desaparecidos.
And so, you know, the country, as you know, has really reached deep levels of violence, and it hit rock bottom with the disappearance of the 43 students from Ayotzinapa, and this was a case that became known around the world.
Tenemos un índice muy alto, muchísimas mujeres. No doy los datos porque no son claros tampoco y creo que son más de los que dice la cifra oficial, pero son miles y miles de mujeres desaparecidas.
And so, you know, within this context, we also have a very high index of women who have been disappeared. And in fact, you know, all official figures, we don't trust them because we believe that the numbers are a lot higher even than those high figures.
Y la mayor, se presupone que las mujeres desaparecidas está relacionado con el narcotráfico para cuestiones de trata y esclavitud sexual.
Supposedly, right, the issue of women's appearance has to do with the role of organized crime and the use of women for prostitution and sex trafficking.
Y el punto que ha hecho crisis con el tema del feminicidio es de que se han impulsado muchas propuestas y políticas públicas, pero tenemos un incremento. Entonces, nadie se explica. O sea, hay un malestar social, un malestar en el movimiento, porque esto pareciera que no se puede parar.
And so, right, within the crisis of femicide, we've pushed through a lot of political initiatives, a lot of political demands, and the government has agreed to apply those, but we still see the rise of femicide, right? And so we have a social illness, really, when it comes to this issue.
México tiene muchísimas recomendaciones, más de 60 recomendaciones internacionales sobre el tema del feminicidio por parte de la ONU. Y el punto donde se atora la situación es en la impartición de justicia, en el sistema de justicia, y en la omisión de las autoridades, y se atora mucho más el impulso de las políticas para protección de las mujeres en los municipios. Okay, tú puedes.
So in Mexico we have more than 60 UN recommendations as to how to deal with violence towards women and femicides, but these public politics get stuck at the point of the justice, for example. Justice is never given to the victims, and the government is also always kind of is very hands off when it comes to women's violence. Especially when it comes to violence at the local level in small cities and towns.
Entonces, ¿qué ha pasado? Que en los últimos 12 años lo que hemos visto es de que han surgido múltiples comités de mujeres buscando a sus hijas, hijos y familiares desaparecidos, grupos de mujeres que se han convertido en rastreadoras, se conoce como las rastreadoras, sobre todo las mujeres en Culiacán y en Sinaloa, que son los grupos emblemáticos, que están buscando y abriendo tumbas.
And so how women have responded to this inaction by the state, right, over the last 12 years is the increase in women's committees that get started, you know, very grassroots committees by families and mostly women who are looking for their disappeared relatives, right, mostly women as well. And we have a lot of these groups that basically they're search parties that are looking, you know, for mass graves or kind of any other grave where unidentified bodies might be buried.
Y en el caso de, es decir, que se generó un clima de impresionante criminalización a las mujeres defensoras de derechos de las mujeres y a mujeres que se practicaban aborto. Tenemos la última investigación realizada por una organización feminista este año, en enero, nos reporta 3.900 mujeres criminalizadas por aborto entre el 2007 y el 2017.
And so another issue that we have, right, is the criminalization and penalizing of women who organize social justice to look for these other women or any other feminist organizations. And at the same time, we have the persecution of women who seek out an abortion. So from 2007 to 2017, we have 3,900 cases of women who have been persecuted for seeking or having an abortion.
Así que, es decir, tenemos un nivel, los niveles de violencia a los que se han llegado en el país, era una sensación de que no podías respirar. Y quiero decir que, por eso, para el conjunto del movimiento organizado, de las personas informadas, los grupos feministas, el surgimiento en 2015 del movimiento Ni Una Menos en Argentina, llegaron los ecos a México. ¿No? Y todo este movimiento global, este ascenso de las mujeres a nivel internacional y latinoamericano, han sido nuevos aires para la organización de las mujeres en México.
Okay, so the levels of violence in Mexico, right, have been unbearable that they were really suffocating. And what we've seen, though, is that, you know, the movement in Latin America, especially Argentina, with the Ni Una Menos campaign, that organizing that was so successful also reached Mexico, right? And now the ascending feminist movement in Latin America is really giving us a lot of confidence in Mexico in new scenario.
Y este contexto internacional en particular también ha llegado a los ecos, por supuesto, la resistencia de las mujeres en Trump, aquí que se vivió después del triunfo, el 21 de enero, ¿no? O 22 de enero, después de que triunfó Trump, y aparte las distintas movilizaciones de las mujeres en Estados Unidos, fundamentalmente la huelga internacional de las mujeres, que en América Latina en el 2007 tuvo una enorme participación, una explosión.
And so in the international context also the feminist movement in Mexico, the women's movement has also gotten more confidence, right, by the movement of resistance here in the United States that comes out of, you know, the post-inauguration march, the women's march after January 21 against Trump, but also with the international women's strike. In Mexico, for example, in 2017, it was a historic year because the feminist movement had one of its largest organized presences around the women's strike.
Voy a mencionar dos ejemplos de los impactos en este contexto en México. Uno que se conoció como la Primavera Violeta, que es una movilización espontánea de mujeres jóvenes a través de las redes sociales. El 24 de abril lograron organizar una movilización nacional en muchísimos, en la mayor parte de los estados del país. Son movilizaciones simbólicas, no masivas, pero es una nueva generación que irrumpió en el escenario del movimiento feminista.
One of the I'm going to give two examples. One of these examples is the Violet Spring. The Violet Spring is an initiative that took place on April 24th, 2016 or 2016. These were very broad mobilizations all across the country in Mexico. Oftentimes mobilizations don't leave Mexico City, but this was remarkable because it was all over the country. Even though these were not large, they were symbolic because it was all over the country. And this also pulled in a new generation of women organizing.
¿Y qué fue lo que marcó la diferencia con esta movilización de esta nueva generación de mujeres jóvenes? Es que es la generación de mujeres que se movilizaban en contra de las violencias machistas y contra el acoso sexual. Normalmente las movilizaciones en México eran en contra del feminicidio, entonces ellas dieron un giro en la demanda, en las consignas, y generaron además un impacto en los medios de comunicación, ¿no? Que difundió mucho esta movilización.
What is different actually, what makes a huge difference in that demonstration of the violet, not violent, right, violet spring, is the right? It is that it's a new generation of women that usually the women that came out were protesting femicides, but this new generation actually was protesting against violence against women, right? But also against sexual harassment, and they began to shift the demands of the movement, and also the media was also very much part of. They also covered this extensively.
Otro momento que quisiera señalar es de que en el contexto de la propuesta que lanzó el Consejo Indígena de Gobierno y el Ejército Zapatista de Liberación Nacional de la vocera Marichuy.
So the other important movement that I want to bring up that has had big impact in the feminist movement is the nomination of María de Jesús Patricio, an indigenous woman known as Marichuy, a campaign supported by the Congress of Indigenous Government, a body that is also supported by the Zapatistas from Chiapas, and this campaign was also really important.
Sorpresivamente, llegó la noticia y la invitación en el mes de diciembre de 2017 para invitando a todas las mujeres del mundo que textual dicen las zapatistas que se resisten y se rebelan en contra del sistema capitalista, machista y patriarcal.
And on December 2017, the Zapatistas also launched an initiative encouraging all women, literally, right, all women from around the world to a congress. And this was a congress for women that resist machista and patriarchal violence, and women that rebel against capitalism, machismo, and patriarchy.
El nombre de este encuentro fue Encuentro Internacional Político, Artístico, Deportivo y Cultural de las Mujeres que Luchan. Y esta convocatoria es muy interesante. Hay análisis y balances que las mismas zapatistas hicieron después del encuentro, que relatan el proceso organizativo que duró meses en todas las comunidades zapatistas y donde participaron más de 2,000 indígenas mujeres preparando este encuentro.
So, the Zapatistas launched an invitation for a women's summit that took place in Chiapas. It was, can I see the title?
Sí, es el primer first encuentro internacional político.
The first international political, artistic, sporting, and cultural summit for women that struggle. And this was a huge initiative by the Zapatistas, and they have chronicled, right, that it took more than 2,000 indigenous women to organize this summit. It was a very important organizational process for Zapatista women as well.
El subcomandante Galeano, antes Marcos, en su balance, en los conversatorios que hicieron de balance de la campaña de Marichuy, mencionaba que había sido así como un sismo o algo así como algo muy fuerte, ¿no?, al interior de las comunidades zapatistas, todo este proceso organizativo. Ellos vienen trabajando desde siempre, ¿no?, en contra del machismo, etcétera, pero pues lo interesante de esto es el efecto que tuvo la candidatura de Marichuy en las comunidades zapatistas.
And according to one of the assessments by one of the leaders of the Zapatista movement, Commander Galeano, who is formerly Marcos, right, the analysis coming from them is that the Marichuy campaign had a really big impact. It was like a political earthquake in the committees of the Zapatistas, especially women's, right, in terms of like women getting involved in that organizational process. And this had a very important political effect to move the women forward to leadership.
El encuentro lo consideramos, y es el análisis de muchas feministas que asistieron y de las mismas zapatistas, como, bueno, obviamente algo histórico. Nunca había habido en México un encuentro de estas características. Llegaron, la convocatoria oscila entre 7,000 y 9,000 mujeres que asistieron al Caracol Morelia en Chiapas.
So the summit, you know, by all accounts, by feminist women who attended, some of them comrades from the PRD, but also from Zapatista women who participated and organized, was that this was really a historic summit. We had never seen this kind of feminist gathering for women only. It's also important to stress that, but this was a women's only space in Chiapas, in the Morelia Caracol. And, you know, between 7,000 to 9,000 women went to Chiapas for three days for the summit.
Hay mucho que hablar sobre este encuentro y creo que se seguirá hablando porque se volverá sin duda alguna en la historia del movimiento feminista y latinoamericano y creo que mundial paradigmático.
And so there's a lot to assess about this summit, right? We're still kind of discussing the aftermath of it. We think that for the women's movement in Mexico and around the world, this is going to be a turning point, right? It is an important paradigm that makes a shift for the women's movement in Mexico.
En primer lugar, porque muestra un cambio en la política, no sé si decirlo, política feminista o en la postura del zapatismo, de recuperar el espacio autónomo de las mujeres.
So the first shift, right, is that within Zapatista politics, and specifically feminist Zapatista politics, is that we are recovering an autonomous space for women.
La segunda consideración que yo haría es de que ayuda o contribuye a cambiar la configuración del movimiento feminista, abriendo una ventana para un feminismo antipatriarcal, anticapitalista, no liberal, no institucionalizado.
So what the other important aspect of this summit is that it helps change and reconfigure the feminist movement because it gives us a window to bring in more women into an anti-capitalist and anti-patriarchal feminist movement, not a feminist movement led by NGOs or led by government offices.
Bueno, aquí cierro yo. Esos son los nuevos aires y quisiera hacer un comentario final sobre el tema que nos... Quería señalar este contexto porque es un poco como ejemplos para expresar las contradicciones que han estado, ¿no?, en la coyuntura mexicana, ¿no? Por un lado, las expresiones de movimiento nuevas que han aparecido, y por otro lado el contexto de violencia de las mujeres o hacia las mujeres, y como un contexto previo a la campaña electoral.
Mm-hmm. So, bueno, durante. And just I want to, you know, now closing on this last point, what I want to do, what I've been trying to do, right, is to provide you a context of how we arrive at this crossroads with the election, in which we have a context of a lot of violence against women and femicides, but we also have a new context of new organizational forms for the feminist movement, and this is part of how we arrive. This is the context, contradictory context in which we arrive at the election.
Estas elecciones han sido las elecciones más violentas de las que tengamos memoria, yo creo, después de la Revolución Mexicana en México.
These have been the most violent electoral period in Mexico since the Mexican Revolution.
Hay aproximadamente 110 políticos y candidatos, entre ellos aproximadamente 17 mujeres que fueron asesinados.
So amongst those who suffered of this electoral violence, we have at least 110 people related to political parties that were killed during this electoral season, and at least also 17 women who were candidates for a post.
El ambiente en México antes de la elección era sí el entusiasmo porque las encuestas daban el posible triunfo de Obrador, pero al mismo tiempo estaba el miedo, el temor de que volviera a haber fraude.
And so, right, the mood before the election was one of enthusiasm because a lot of the polls gave AMLO a clear victory. But there was also a lot of fear because of the potential for another electoral fraud.
O sea, la típica conversación entre los mexicanos en esos días previos a la elección era, ¿y tú crees que pasará?
So, right.
¿Lo dejarán?
So the typical conversation amongst all of us really has been, do you think that, you know, AMLO will, they will let him have it this time? You know, do you think that he will really be able to win? Even though the polls were saying, you know, that he would.
Bueno, y una cuestión que es sorprendente, y pienso que la prensa con el triunfo de Obrador no reaccionó tan rápidamente a esta noticia, pero es de que por primera vez en México vamos a tener un Senado con mayoría mujeres.
So, one of the things that is very surprising as an aftermath of AMLO's election is that, and something that the press hasn't really picked up yet, they're barely catching up on, is that for the first time in Mexican history, the Senate is going to be composed of 50% more women than men.
Y igual la paridad queda establecida en la Cámara de Diputados.
And in the Chamber of Deputies, the lower house of the Senate, we also have a majority of women. I think it's 51%.
Lo que sí quiero decir que es importante es que esto no quiere decir que eso se dio por Obrador, ¿no? O sea, esto se dio porque en el 2013, en el periodo de Peña Nieto, él mandó una iniciativa y se aprobó la paridad como una norma electoral en el Congreso de la Unión. O sea, que hubiera pasado con o sin Obrador.
So, I also want to highlight, though, that the women becoming, having parity with men in the Congress, right, is not that this is something that Obrador did. This is a law that women had fought for since 2013 and that the previous president had enacted so that there would be parity for women in all political parties. So all political parties have to put the same amount of women candidates and male candidates in their voting rolls.
El otro tema que destaca de, ya voy a terminar, I'm finishing, I'm sorry. El otro tema que destaca es de que el gabinete de gobierno de Obrador es paritario. Eso sí es propuesta de Obrador y de sus asesores.
So another important thing to underline, which is part of Obrador's plan, right, is that his cabinet is going to have gender parity, and this is something that he made sure to have.
La otra cosa a destacar con relación al avance de las mujeres es que la jefa de gobierno de la Ciudad de México sería la primera mujer que es votada en elecciones.
And another important thing to underline is that for the first time in Mexican history, the mayor of Mexico City is going to be a woman. Is going to be a woman, right, who has been voted for the first time. In the past, we had an interim person, but this time it was through popular vote, the first time that we get a woman in Mexico City as mayor.
Y el otro elemento que me parece, no voy a hablar más de lo que es la ofensiva de la derecha porque ya lo mencionaron ellos, pero lo que sí es importante destacar es de que hay un debate con Obrador, del movimiento feminista con él, por su posición frente al aborto.
Mm-hmm. Right, so I'm not going to go into the role of the right anymore because we've talked about it, but there is a big debate with the feminist movement and Obrador about his position on abortion.
Porque él en su campaña de 2012 lo que dijo fue que él pondría esto a referéndum.
Right, so in his 2012 campaign he said that abortion would be put up to a popular vote in a referendum.
Y eso generó un debate muy fuerte en el sentido de que el movimiento le dijo los derechos no se ponen a referéndum.
Right, and the feminist movement said of course you do not put a women's rights for a referendum.
So ahí tenemos una discrepancia muy fuerte, ¿no? Con él y bueno, vamos a ver qué pasa ahora, ¿no? Porque hay dos iniciativas en el Congreso Federal, o sea, en el Congreso de la Unión, en la Cámara de Diputados, para legislar continuar la estrategia de la derecha para legislar el derecho a la concepción desde la vida.
And so we'll see what happens, right? I mean, at the moment we have this other discrepancy that the right wing, for example, has two initiatives waiting in the wings in the Senate to recognize life at the beginning of life at conception. So we'll see where it goes with it.
Bueno, o sea, creo que esos avances que se han reflejado con la paridad también son históricos. Para muchas mujeres es el avance más importante que han tenido las mujeres en el tema de la representación formal después de que conseguimos el voto en 1953.
So for women, the current, you know, gender parity in the government is quite historic. In fact, for many women, it is one of the most important victories for the feminist movement, right? This equal representation, and it is as important as women getting the right to vote.
Y lo están celebrando, pero en las redes sociales con una felicidad impresionante, ¿no? A que ha generado mucha ilusión.
And so, of course, you know, in social media, women are really celebrating this. There's a lot of hope as well.
Yo nada más diría para finalizar que se introducen algunas expectativas en general para la población mexicana con este triunfo y para muchas mujeres también, de que pueda haber cambios, ¿no?, en la situación, que como dijeron los compañeros está por verse. Pero en el caso del movimiento y de la construcción de un movimiento activo, radical, feminista, me parece que lo que ahorita nosotros estaríamos proponiendo al movimiento y que pensamos que esa es la línea por donde habría que avanzar es darle más fuerza a la presión política sobre los temas que pensamos que no van a ser tocados, ¿no?, y que van a ser soslayados. O sea, no podemos bajar la guardia ni pensar que la paridad y las mujeres allá adentro, que muchas no son feministas, nos va a garantizar los cambios que solamente la organización de nosotras, ¿no?, autónomas, como mujeres, nosotras dirigiendo nuestro movimiento, podemos empujar.
Thank you. So I'll just close with Josie's last comment. It's okay. It's okay. It's very important, right? That, you know, obviously having a lot of women in the Senate and gender parity does not equal women's equality. So what the feminist movement is going to have to do is to, you know, continue being radical, active, and resistant. The next step should be to apply political pressure to the new government, right? So that women autonomously, like they've always done, will win victories for themselves.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.